I'm Pete Myers with Catholic Charities, and my particular interest in this issue is because I work with people who are, most of the people in the program are in welfare-to-work programs, where they're being pushed into jobs which are clearly not paying living wages. And part of the welfare situation these days is you're not really allowed to go into training, so you've got to work 40, 50, 60 hours a week, making minimum wage, basically. Mm-hmm. So that's one of my particular interests in getting involved with this. The coalition in Ithaca is, in Tompkins County, is different than a lot of living wage coalitions around the state, in the sense that we are looking into the possibility of a living wage ordinance, but we're working on many different fronts because some of the criticism of living wage ordinances around the state, around the country, is that they affect a pretty small amount of people. So we're focusing in many different ways, city, county, state, national, to affect this issue. So it's much broader than, than just an ordinance. The first thing I was going to just briefly talk about was the history of the Living Wage Coalition. And, about 3 years ago, the county passed a resolution which basically would fund any human service agency that had a contract with the county. They would then pay a living wage, and the county would give that money to that agency to pay that living wage. That's a big feature and big controversy in New York City's campaign right now. We're talking about millions and millions of dollars that go to human service agencies, and the human service agencies are saying, how could we pay that? Well, part of the bill is saying that the city would come up with that money. Our biggest campaign, and it has actually been in the last 6 months, has actually been kind of our Living Wage Coalition working with Ithaca Paraprofessionals Association, which is a union campaign, but is joined up with, we see our campaign as a community campaign. We're not a labor campaign, but we're joining up with them to achieve a living wage. Ithaca Paraprofessionals, for your information, have been making, about one half of them make under $12,000 a year, working 30 to 35 hours a week. And one third of them make under $10,000 a year. And whether you're in the city or in the county, I can bet your bottom dollar that paraprofessionals, whatever school district we're talking about, are making the same low wages. So we've had a quite active campaign in the last 6 months for that, including the making of a video called The Hands That Help. That video is going to be, again, shown September 6th at the Women's Opportunity Center at 7:30. We've had an active petition campaign, had 2,500 people in the county sign a petition to increase the wages of the paraprofessionals. Basically, what the Living Wage Coalition is asking for is an increase to $14,000 minimum based on a 10-month year. The living wage right now for Tompkins County is estimated at $17,500 approximately. So $14,000 for a paraprofessional, those are teacher's aides, teaching assistants, family liaisons, bus aides. That would be prorated to the $17,500. We've also had vigils on behalf of this issue. We've had a pretty good letter-writing campaign to the newspapers, Ithaca Times, Ithaca Journal. We've had a public hearing. This has been a really good example of the coalition working with the union. People may have seen the Ithaca Times article about 6 months ago, a cover story on the living wage issue, and I contrasted our working with the Paraprofessionals Association with the people that we work with at Catholic Charities. I work, for example, with a person in this welfare-to-work program who was very blessed to get a job making $10 an hour. And about 2% of the people we work with are blessed like that. So oftentimes I think to myself, without unions, I'm not sure what hope a lot of the people that we work with have. The hope is that they're one of the lucky few that get picked for a $10 an hour job. That's the hope that they have. So I think it's, I don't know, it's an issue we need to struggle through, I think. It's an important issue about the union issue. Another campaign that we've been, an integral part of what we've been doing is the Cornell campaign for a living wage. Basically trying to raise consciousness on Cornell's campus about living wage issues. A significant victory was won by our campaign along with the United Auto Workers 2300, which got a 5% increase for the next 4 years for everybody who's part of the union at Cornell. Unfortunately, only 15 to 20% of the campus is unionized, so there's a lot of people that are still making, should be making a lot more, and we're still in the process of researching. There's quite a few workers up at Cornell who are temp workers that are making $6, $7 an hour, so we're still, in the fall, we'll kind of be pushing on with that campaign even more. I'm very excited about CRESP, which is the Center for Religious Ethics and Social Policy, just hired a part-time person to work specifically on the living wage campaign, and that person is working more in town than on Cornell. And we've been canvassing, going door to door right now in the city. We plan to get out in the county as much as possible. That's really exciting because we're touching people who are not necessarily, we're not preaching to the converted. We're talking to people just at the grassroots about that.
And a lot of that is just getting information from the people. You know, have you heard about this issue? How do you feel about it? Mm-hmm. It's not really trying to impress a certain point of view on anybody. It's really getting information from the community so that we better understand what the issues are ourselves.
Mm-hmm. If anybody would be interested in going door-to-door, learning how to do that, we're going to be having a training on Tuesday, September 4th at 7 p.m. at Catholic Charities, which is 324 West Buffalo. And we're also doing tabling as well at a couple institutions in town. If you'd be interested in tabling either at your church or in your community somewhere, please talk to me or to Edie after this, and we can show you how to do that. I mean, we'd come out to your location, and we'd show you how to do that. As I said, we're really trying to focus on as many different levels as possible with this. On the local level, we are working to possibly, we're dialoguing right now with the city council very actively about living wage ordinance possibility. If you look in your packet, I think the Religious Task Force has come up with different possibilities that your congregation or your synagogue or church could come up with. So you'll see a number of different postcards there. The actual postcard, there's a yellow postcard that says to your council member, that's for city level. What it's basically asking the council member to do is development should be tied into living wages for one thing. It's a difficult issue. Like Brian was saying with regards to Rochester, we just met with Pat Pryor and Joni Spielholz this past week on the city council. And they were saying, you know, we've got some new development projects coming into Ithaca, and they're kind of really concerned about a living wage ordinance that, for example, with the new hotel that's possibly coming in, if we have a living wage ordinance on the books, then that hotel might very easily go to Lansing. A lot of businesses are going to Lansing where the mall is, and most likely the hotel, if there was a living wage ordinance, would say, we're not going to deal with Ithaca. Mm-hmm. So it's a real issue of concern. We need to also be, we're also dialoguing with the county as well. Then there's a postcard, another, we're doing exactly the same postcard with the county. It says, Dear Board Member, County Board of Representatives, and we're actually having a little bit more success right now with the county. We're meeting with Tompkins County Area Development, and they are actually looking to put into their standards criteria for living wages, amongst other things. So that's a good thing. What would affect many more people on a statewide level is the increase of a minimum wage on the statewide level from $5.15 to $6.75 an hour. Just quickly, I'll mention that what's happening at the state level is the Assembly has overwhelmingly passed this legislation to raise it to $6.75 an hour. The Senate, from what I understand, is supporting it two-thirds, has a two-thirds support for it, and Pataki would most likely veto it, but it wouldn't matter because of that Senate support, but it won't even get out of the Labor Committee right now. So there's a campaign right now to pressure the Senate. Right now, one of our people talked to Marty Luster, who's our assemblyman, about 2 days ago, and he is saying that there's, because of the budget stuff, there's probably not going to be anything happening between now and January, but the Assembly and the Senate come back in January, so we're continuing with this campaign and hoping to basically flood the offices of Pataki, the Green Postcard, and Joseph Bruno, who's the Senate Majority Leader, and Jim Seward and Randy Kuhl, who are the local Senate leaders. We've also worked on welfare reauthorization. 5 years ago, President Clinton and the House and Senate on the national level passed legislation which drastically changed the welfare system in this country, kicking people off of welfare after 5 years. That's about to come to an end. And we're working to have that reauthorized in a way that would more suit the people that we work with, being more patient, having training possibly for them. It's a pretty broad issue. I won't go into a lot of details about that. We had 500 postcards sent in for that. Briefly, just in terms of action steps, we also really look to develop a speakers bureau. In the next couple months, we hope to have a national coordinator of the living wage movement with ACORN come to Ithaca to do trainings for people in a speakers bureau. So if you'd be interested in being a speakers bureau, definitely let us know. And especially if you'd be interested in having somebody come to your congregation or to your church or synagogue, let us know, and we can send somebody out to do that. We could actually probably do that now. We have general meetings once a month with Catholic Charities. The next general meeting is Thursday night, 7 p.m., September 20th, Catholic Charities, 324 West Buffalo. We have steering committee meetings on average about every 2 weeks. The next one is Thursday, September 6th at 4 p.m. So we don't have a lot of meetings with the Living Wage Coalition, as you can, being facetious, we've got a lot of meetings. So I think that's all I have, and just take a couple minutes for questions if you have any questions about what's going on the local level.
I want to say two things. One is that I think we have to remember, in terms of asking the economic question, how does this thing really work, that at a national level, when we look at the minimum wage, originally the philosophy that underpinned the creation of the minimum wage was that we need to give every worker enough money to live on. That was the original philosophy. And over the years, since the Reagan administration, basically, and beyond, the attitude has become that the minimum wage is inhibiting job growth, because you sort of, if people are willing to work for a dollar an hour, why not employ them at a dollar an hour? And I think we have to realize that that philosophy is immoral, unethical. How low are we going to go? If people are so desperate that they're willing to work for 50 cents, is that okay? We have to go back, I think, to the original philosophy and intent of the minimum wage, which was established in order to give every worker enough money to be able to live on. If you do that, and the Bush administration sees this also, you encourage economic growth by virtue of the fact that there's a multiplier effect. People have money in their pocket, and they're going to spend it, and economic development comes from that. So I think we have to keep that in mind. The second thing I wanted to mention also at a national level is that I think economic justice is an important way to frame this issue, because we're not just talking about wages, but we're talking about other things that make workers' lives work. And that can include daycare, universal daycare, health care, other features that allow people to be able to survive from day to day. My background is German. I have a lot of family members that live in Europe. And when I was speaking to some of my family members this summer about this living wage issue, and we were comparing wages of low-income earners, and one of my uncles says, well, you know, wages in Germany aren't that much different. They may be a little higher. So what's the issue? And I said, well, you don't need to save for college education for your kids. You don't need to pay any additional health care costs. You don't need to pay any additional daycare costs, because daycare is universally provided by the government. Those are three huge outlays that our workers all need to deal with themselves. I think we need to remember that the government also bears some responsibility, not just the individual employer, so that the small business owner can pay a wage that is then supplemented by the society that cares for not just the workers, but the children of these workers. And I'd just like to make one last point. Child poverty in the United States is 20%. In New York State, it's 26%. It is the highest child poverty in all industrialized countries by far. Canada has a child poverty rate of 40%. Sweden has a child poverty rate of 2.4%. European countries generally have a poverty rate that ranges in the tens to the low teens. And ours is 20%. I think that's a sin.
That was Pete Myers and Uncle Wessel speaking to religious leaders in Tompkins County last August. Since the 1980s, business-backed politicians have waged a campaign of defamation on poor people, trying to equate poverty with laziness. Social programs of various kinds have been slashed, with the claims that these cuts will motivate these loafers to get a job. The fact is that the hardest jobs in this society are also usually the lowest paid, and the poorest among us often work the hardest of all. So-called prosperity, which has raised wages at the top of the scale, only serves to make the costs of basic necessities more out of reach for those on the lowest end. This has contributed to the growing tide of homelessness among people who work full-time jobs, a new report shows.
Growing gap between minimum wage and housing costs, from the Dow Jones Newswires. The average U.S. worker must earn at least $13.87 an hour, nearly three times the federal minimum wage, to pay the rent on even a modest two-bedroom apartment, according to a private study released Tuesday. As in the past, the annual Out of Reach report by the National Low-Income Housing Coalition found there is no jurisdiction in the country where someone working full-time at the $5.15 an hour federal minimum wage can afford an apartment. This year, the analysis concluded the gap between a minimum wage salary and the cost of housing grew faster than before and widened virtually everywhere. The Washington-based advocacy group favors increased federal spending on affordable housing and raising the minimum wage. Housing is the beginning, the foundation, the stability that people must have to go to work each day, send their children to school, arrange transportation and childcare, and generally succeed in life, the report said. Senator Jack Reed, Democrat of Rhode Island, chairman of the Senate Housing Subcommittee, said the report shows the shortcomings of federal policy, including years of declining federal funding for affordable housing. It would seem self-evident that if one goes to work every day and collects a regular paycheck, that should be enough to secure a reasonable place to live and take care of one's family, Reed said. The study is based on the Department of Housing and Urban Development's determinations of fair market rent in 3,779 states, counties, and metropolitan areas. Each jurisdiction's, quote, housing wage, unquote, was then established by calculating how much a person would need to earn per hour to pay no more than 30% of income for those rents. HUD considers housing affordable when it costs 30% or less of gross income. The national housing wage of $13.87 is less than the $16.97 an hour the average U.S. worker earned in 2000, according to a Bureau of Labor Statistics report covering nearly all American employees, or about 125 million workers. But it is far more than the federal minimum wage of $5.15 an hour earned by 2.7 million people in 2000. Workers in California and the Mid-Atlantic region of the East Coast needed the most income to afford a modest two-bedroom apartment, while those in Puerto Rico and much of the Deep South needed the least, the report showed. In a third of all jurisdictions, the housing wage is more than twice the area's minimum wage, meaning a family needs at least two full-time minimum wage earners to afford even modest rental housing. 10 states and the District of Columbia have set minimum wages above the federal figure. And while most minimum wage standards didn't rise, the housing wage increased everywhere but Madison County, Missouri, the report found. The study examined data from all 50 states, the District of Columbia, and Puerto Rico, as well as from all metropolitan areas and counties.
That was the Growing Gap Between Minimum Wage, Housing, Rent, Cost report, published on October 2nd on the Dow Jones Newswire. The Department of Housing and Urban Development has initiated a program called HOPE 6, which officially describes its purpose as to, quote, improve the living environment for public housing residents of severely distressed public housing projects through the demolition, rehabilitation, reconfiguration or replacement of obsolete public housing projects, close quote. In reality, this so-called public-private initiative is designed to remove poor residents from urban areas that can now be profitable to real estate developers. One such example is the situation of the Arthur Capper and Carrollsburg dwellings in Southeast Washington, D.C., which has provided housing and community for 40 years in that neighborhood. This in a city where a tiny one-bedroom apartment costs close to $800 a month. City officials working hand-in-hand with developers publicly claim that the current residents will be able to return to the new gentrified community. Off the record, it's a different story. A local resident asked D.C. Housing Authority Executive Director Michael Kelly how many current residents were expected to be able to come back and buy homes in the new development. I guess he didn't realize he was talking to a resident, the man said. He thought I was someone working with the development team because he just said, "Probably zero," and then he laughed. The residents are fighting to stop the forced eviction and to gain control of the management of the housing project themselves. We spoke with one resident activist last week on the streets of Washington, D.C.
Yes, yeah, so my name is Stephen Davis. I'm a resident of Carlsberg Drelling, Arthur Kappa and Carlsberg Drelling. Right now we're in the process of trying to announce ourselves or unite ourselves to fight DCHA to displace us from our home. And we feel as a community that we have strong ties in that area. We have generations of families have been living there on low income, or that's on disabled or senior citizens. And we are a community that are strongly held together by our ties with the churches, schools, and all that. But we feel we are being forced out of our homes, our low-income homes, which we can afford, to displace to a place where they have no room for us. And by dividing our families and friends from one another, we feel that the only way we can our message to get across is by we holding on October the 1st. We hold to HUD, and we have already got petitions. We got 90% of the community that says we do not want to change. We do not need that change. We, under the Hope 6 application, the way it stands now is no, they have no provisions in it for low-income senior citizens and disabled people. And we want to fix the Hope 6. We like the concept of the Hope 6, but the application itself is completely destroying and disrupting the 4,000 individuals that live in Arthur Kappa and Carlsberg Drelling, and it's disrupting our lives. We have no certainty of where we're going to be living if that application is approved.
Okay, now why is the D.C. Housing Authority trying to remove you from your homes? What is their excuse? And if you think there's a different reason that they're not telling the truth about that, perhaps, what is that? What's at stake here?
I believe that it's about the prime real estate our area is located and the marketing value of that area, which, and it's about dollars and cents. Under the Bush administration, we see at the closing of D.C. General, the removal of the poor people out of the city, they're bringing the not affordable houses, they're bringing a market value here into the city, which low-income people are not able to sustain in the system. So I think that what they are, their plans are, is to eliminate us all together, to put us on the other side of the river, and Potomac on the other side of the river in Virginia or Maryland. And there's no homes out there for us. And we feel that it's all about the dollars and cents.
How much does a person have to pay right now to live in the Carrollton Homes or the Arthur Kappa? Can you live there free? Are there housing vouchers? How does that work?
People pay different amounts. But on fixed income, it goes to one-third of your whatever you get. So that's making affordable housing. But the way we have it set up, if they give you a Section 8 voucher to move and you're on a fixed income, and that voucher will not cover any utilities that one might have to pay with children or whatever. And now private, we're finding out that under the current system with the Section 8 vouchers is only good for 1 year, that right now they have over 12,000 people with the voucher, and only 50% of them can find affordable housing. So that's over roughly 6,000 people that have vouchers with no place to live. I just talked to one gentleman with a voucher, and he hasn't found home yet, and he's been in the city now for at least 5 years. And that is the problem with the way the system is run. And if the government decides to, Congress decides to not to fund housing with the vouchers in it, they're going to displace thousands of families. They're going to make us literally homeless.
Okay, who controls the D.C. Housing Authority? How do these people get in the position to make these decisions about your life? Who are they?
Well, it all boils down to our elected official. And our pleas has so far been falling on deaf ears within the structure of the government. We are demanding our elected officials that we put in office to hear our pleas and not those of corporate America, the ones that are not. This is our home, and we feel that we have the right to say where we want to live under the United States of America. If we want to live in that neighborhood, we should have that right. Not to be told we have no right. They're just going to move us where they want to move us. And we feel we are being displaced like the American Indians was displaced from this country.
Okay, now is the Arthur Capper Homes, is that owned by Washington, D.C.? It's owned by the city of Washington, D.C. Okay, what support have you had from your elected officials? Have any of them said that they're going to support your efforts to save your homes, or are they all on the other side?
They're all on the other side.
So are they trying to sell that land to private developers? Is that what they're trying to do? If they sold that land, whose pockets would that money go into?
I believe that is going into corporate America is going into, like anybody, a politician's pocket. The politics are benefiting from that. So will the banks. One of the head member of the Mid-Atlantic Corporation, we have evidence that he was guilty of a land scam in Seattle. But under this previous application, he's asking the government to give him a $35 million of our tax-earned dollars to help fund this Hope 6 project. And if he served 5 years in Seattle and was also had to pay back $2.8 million in restitution, why is the government is thinking and considering giving him $35 million of our tax dollars?
Okay, so there are tax dollars that will also go into this Hope 6 project. It's not a purely privately owned thing that they're planning, correct?
Correct. Yeah. They just put up two major office buildings. And under the proposal, they had to the community and said that this will bring jobs in the community. There's not one resident that many hundreds that put in applications for office cleaning, parking garage attendants, the cafeteria workers, they didn't hire not one resident. So we didn't feel we didn't benefit at all having them put these office buildings here at the Navy Yard. And right now, our resident councils in our building are not keeping the tenants informed on meetings, proposals that's being made, or what's really going on. And we feel they are also benefiting with coming down to that they are promised them jobs once the community finish. And so they are backsliding on the residents, and they hold a position that they're supposed to be looking out for our best interest. So the only alternative we have is to fight for ourselves.
And how long has the fight been going on? What have people been doing in the community to fight this?
We've been going door to door, getting signatures on petitions. We've been having strategy meetings. We're having a protest at HUD on October the 1st, Monday, tomorrow, at 12 o'clock. We're taking together down with our signatures that we have received. We have sent letters to the Secretary of HUD. We didn't send them to all of his right-arm men. We're asking for a sit-down. We're asking to discuss some of the provisions in the HOPE 6 application, see if we can fix it so that the people should not have to be forced out of their home. We don't want to be displaced, not even on a temporary basis. We feel that they can work on one section at a time and move us right back in. But under the current proposal, the only way you can come back, they're going to have a board in the community that's going to have to interview you to see if you can come back into the area. And that is something they didn't tell us. We have been lied to on the HOPE 6 project from the beginning, from day one. They didn't give us ample enough time or fact-figuring, finding evidence to support our position. And so we are saying we were lied to, misled us in every step of the way, and they broke the law on how they handle the HOPE 6 application and for the community. So if we need to, we're going to take legal action.
A lot of times people are afraid to get involved in a political struggle, afraid to demonstrate and do these kinds of things. Are you finding that people in your community are angry enough to come forward? You know, how has that been for you in trying to organize your community? What's that been like?
It's been hard. It's been hard, but I knew it was going to be hard when I took it on. And it's like it's nothing in it for me. And some people are afraid of the government. They feel they held the power. My best weapon is educating them in that these officials don't tell us we're supposed to let them know of our concern and demand them. We elected them for that reason, to listen and get for our concern. And we are trying to let them know we vote them in, we can vote them out, or we can petition to have them out. But the same thing I was telling them, as they tell about Bush military, his military fight, we have a fight. And I'm not willing to give it up. And I'll do everything I have to do, because I cannot stand by, because I'm angry when somebody's telling me I have to move. I got to move for some big other project.
Is there anything else that people outside of your community can do to help? How can others help who might hear this somewhere else?
Well, this is a global thing that is happening, not just here in Washington, D.C., and we are trying to unite other public housing resident councils, and we're trying to come together as one big unit to be heard from north, south, east, and west. And because we're all facing the same concerns. And we've seen it happen in Atlanta, in Florida, in New Jersey, New York. It's almost as I feel that they are trying to eliminate the unnecessary people. They call us the unnecessary, the low incomes, the senior citizens, and the disabled. Well, they're just trying to eliminate us out of the whole picture. I see the tax dollars going into the new convention center, the restaurants that are going up. They feel the disabled, the fixed income, low income is not generating any money in this area. So let's fix up D.C. and bring back the people that can afford the $250,000, $300,000condominiums, townhouses, and they are the ones who are going to generate the income for the theaters, the restaurants, the convention center. And so in that aspect, there's like, we just don't need y'all anymore. Being pushed aside. I just like that, let the people know that we are fighting for what we believe in, and we're just not going to lay down and be run over or ran out. And I will do anything and everything I have to do to, especially when I'm right, I will fight.
Is there a phone number if people want to offer some sort of help or solidarity? Is there something that they can call?
Yes. Number is area code 202-547-3039.
That was Stephen Davis, a low-income housing resident from the Carrollsburg Dwellings Housing Project in southeast Washington, D.C. The lack of democracy, the disparities in wealth, the destruction of the environment, and the domination of society by corporate profiteers has not changed since the events of September 11th. If anything, government and business are using the tragedy as an excuse to crush dissent while speeding the country along the road to more corporatization and less real freedom for most of us. Canadian anti-capitalist activist Jaggi Singh spoke with Lorraine Chisholm of Vancouver Cooperative Radio about the effects of the bombings on the anti-globalization movement.
The terrorist attacks of September 11th have presented the anti-globalization movement with new and unanticipated challenges. Many people have switched their priorities from challenging corporate power to mobilizing against military retaliation abroad and racism at home. Others argue that now more than ever we need a global movement for a fairer world. Jaggi Singh is a Montreal area activist and organizer. He was involved in organizing against APEC and the Summit of the Americas in Quebec City and is a member of CLAC, a French acronym which stands for the Anti-Capitalist Convergence. He joins me by phone this morning from Victoria, where he's attending a conference on ending global militarism. Good morning, Jaggi.
Hi, Lorraine.
What's been the immediate effect of September 11th on the anti-globalization movement here in Canada?
Well, I think that term, anti-globalization movement, has always been problematic. It's sort of been used to as a catch-all for very different tendencies that are opposing corporate or capitalist globalization. And I think we've seen reactions, not just in Canada, but North America, that range from what I would call cowardice to courageous. The cowardly reaction are the reactions that are urging a retreat, urging us to be more quiet, to sort of surrender the political terrain to the people who are taking it over now, which are the jingoists and the people crying for war. So, for example, we've seen a letter by Buzz Hargrove, who has urged that unions not participate in mobilizations against the World Trade Organization on November 9th. Or in the United States, we've seen major groups like the American Federation of Labor, such as the Friends of the Earth, canceling demonstrations. Most troublingly, the Mobilization for Global Justice in Washington canceled their demonstrations on the streets of Washington. And I think that's very problematic. You cannot surrender the terrain. But alternatively, you have seen reactions where people are organizing quite vigorously against racism, against war, making the links to globalization, and they are not difficult links to make. Many people within this broadly based anti-globalization movement have had an analysis of capitalism and imperialism, which I think are words that we need to reclaim, especially in the current context. And there are people going ahead with demonstrations worldwide today, September 29th, linking the economic destruction of the policies of the IMF, the World Bank, and various governments to global militarism and the rush to war. And I think that's very positive. And ultimately, I think it's going to take some time to really suss out to what extent the so-called anti-globalization movement is going to react to the new political context that we find ourselves in.
Now, I know from speaking to friends who are in the States right now, activists who are in the States, that is a very different atmosphere there, and I imagine the chilling effect will be much more severe there for people working on issues of globalization. Do you have a sense of how American anti-globalization activists are responding?
Well, I think it's actually quite positive. Even at ground zero in New York City, where quite obviously people have been traumatized by the devastation that they've seen around them, there have been significant anti-war mobilizations going on in New York. Of course, people need time in New York to respond to the devastation around them and to assure that their friends and family are okay and to respond to sort of the humanitarian situation there. But there are responses, and there's this tendency to think that somehow victims and people who are seeing the devastation, such as in New York, would be the ones that are most likely to be pro-war and seek revenge. And actually, from a lot of what I'm reading and a lot of what I'm observing, it's the complete opposite. People who've had devastation visited upon them do not wish that upon anyone else. I don't want to pretend like that obviously is the prevailing point of view, but certainly it is a dissenting point of view that is more and more common that we're hearing even at the vigil that was held at Yankee Stadium. Many victims, families of victims, were saying that this is not about revenge. There's even the family of one particular victim that wrote out an email and sent it out saying, not in my son's name. That is, don't go to war in my son's name. If you're going to come with another excuse, go ahead and do so, but don't use this tragedy to justify your own prerogative. So I think that's very, very heartening. And we have a lot of allies in the belly of the beast in the United States. And again, it'll take time for that to emerge. But I think what might have taken 6 months in the 1960s in terms of the anti-war movement, what might have taken 6 years back then might take just 6 months today, because we have, I think, a stronger movement, networks that have formed. And that comes out of the anti-globalization movement. That also comes out of the mobilizations against the Gulf War in 91. And I think people have less illusions about how the West, and particularly the United States, exercises its power. So I think those are all things that we can rely on to build a very very strong anti-war, anti-racist, and I think anti-imperialist mobilization.
Now we've already been witnessing an increasingly violent response on the part of the police to street protests. Do you anticipate that they'll now attempt to shut down all forms of legal street protests that we saw on the scale in Seattle and in Quebec City?
Well, I guess we'll only really know when the next mobilizations happen. There are some today, but that's when we'll really know. But I mean, I guess we can speculate, and what we can say is, first of all, the slow criminalization of dissent that we've seen since Vancouver towards a certain segment of the population, because, of course, Native people and other people have been living that criminalization for their entire lives, but that slow criminalization of dissent is going to be that much more speeded up. And McClellan has announced changes to Terrorism Act and you know, national security, which are quite troubling, the speculation around that. So that's just going to be that much more speeded up. As well, in this context of war hysteria and jingoism, there's a lot of what I call sloppy thinking going on, and cheap shots, a bit of both. And you have this weird link being made between a classically defined terrorist act, such as taking a civilian plane into a civilian building and killing thousands of innocent people, and vigorous street protests. And these kind of cheap shots are being made by mainly in the business pages. For example, a Globe and Mail commentator, Bruce McKenna, in the Globe yesterday, basically compared student protesters and terrorists, and saying the police in Washington had to deal with both, as if they're on the same continuum. So we just have to be that much more assertive, but not retreat. But as to how the police will react on the streets, certainly this gives them, I think, more of a free hand. And unfortunately, over the last 2 or 3 weeks, we've seen, I think, just through all the intense media hype and propaganda, people probably relying more on the police and CSIS to solve their problems, when perhaps before September 11th, at least in Canada, there was much more skepticism that those organizations could serve any useful role in favor of social justice.
I think you make a very strong point about the media and some commentators taking cheap shots and trying to line up people who are expressing dissent and these crimes of terrorism. But I also know that you've been part of a discussion within the anti-globalization movement around a diversity of tactics, and your position has been to respect a diversity of tactics. And I'm wondering if you think that this debate will be affected by what happened on September 11th?
Yes and no. I mean, for the really, how would you say, for the people within the movement who want to take cheap shots, I guess that's an easy one to take. You believe in a respect for diversity of tactics. Does that include riding planes into civilian buildings? Well, respect for diversity of tactics has never been about making a call for armed struggle. That's not our place to make. That's not our call to make. I think we have to understand the context of where that comes out of. Actually, a lot of posters, a lot of statements, a lot of articles that were made before September 11th are now being reevaluated, because obviously things take on a new resonance, right? A lot of symbolism about, you know, the Tower of Babel or the Tower of Capitalism falling down sort of takes on a new meaning when there was this disaster in New York City. But remember that the context of how diversity tactics was, you know, where that came out of was to show a solidarity with oppressed peoples worldwide, first of all. That is that people around the world are using different sorts of tactics in order to fight for social justice. And we can't really inoculate ourselves and isolate ourselves from that reality in the North. So it's a statement of solidarity. And secondly, it's trying to create a measure of safety and security within demonstration situations by being aware of different tactical methods of engaging the police, and more importantly, not denouncing elements of the movement that, while we might disagree with their tactics, are part of our movement. So, for example, when homeless people and street youth in Toronto, in the course of a demonstration, might engage the police in a way that, I guess, the mainstream middle-class public doesn't find very palatable, I don't think the response should be to further marginalize those people who are marginalized. So I think ultimately those issues are still the same. But I think, obviously, those of us who've been fighting for a more solidarity-oriented movement rather than a tactical purity of either nonviolence or tactical purity of just armed struggle, those of us who have been urging that solidarity through using this term respect for diversity of tactics, we just have to be that much more vigilant and respond to these cheap shots that some might make. Although, to be fair, I really haven't heard that. because those commentators in the Globe and Mail and the National Post who are making those cheap shots, they're not making those distinctions about people who are for respect for diversity of tactics or people who are nonviolent. They're dismissing the entire anti-globalization movement because they object to it on ideological grounds. So we can't lose sight of that either.
Right. Many people who participated in the in opposition to the summons in Seattle and Quebec City came home reaffirming their commitment to the day-to-day frontline work on local issues. How is this kind of work going to be affected now that there's an obvious need to refocus? I mean, I think this is a big challenge for us, and how to respond to the many, many struggles that we have, you know, right at home, and also deal with this. Anti-war movement that we need to build?
Well, whether we like it or not, we have to adjust, because the nature of living in an empire is that the emperor decides our priorities for us. And certainly with the war hysteria, the racism, the jingoism, we have to respond. And it's not a trivial matter. There's going to be an all-out assault on immigration and refugees, on those laws. There's talk of creating a U.S.-Canadian perimeter. That is while there is a refugee crisis worldwide, to be that much more of a crisis with potentially millions of Afghanis fleeing. So we need to be that much more vigilant on that issue, on racism. And I think one way that the argument of fighting on the local ground has been expressed is that we have to fight on issues that matter to everyday people. And I think racism and issues around immigration and refugee issues are those issues that matter, and specifically they matter to people of color, which hits on another critique that has been made of the anti-globalization movement in the North, which is that it doesn't represent people of color and people who are on the front lines of oppression. So I don't think there's really any trade-offs to make. I think, again, the link between responding to what we're seeing now post-September 11th and to the issues that we've been fighting around capitalist globalization, they're not tenuous, they're not indirect, they're very direct. And if anything, it forces us to be that much more assertive and that much more public. And in many ways, we're seeing the fair weather kind of activism exposed in the anti-globalization movement, because those fair weather people are like sort of in a period of mourning. If we were to mourn every time there was a disaster or a tragedy, we'd never organize. This is not the time to mourn. It's a time to organize. It's a time to organize because we don't want to trivialize that loss of life in New York City, because we don't want to trivialize the loss of life daily that's happening in Iraq due to sanctions. We don't want to trivialize the human misery and suffering that's happening as a result of the refugee crisis in Afghanistan and elsewhere. So those issues are more relevant than ever, and specifically on immigrant refugee issues, on refugee and on racism issues, there's a huge challenge there. And this is no longer just an anti-war movement. It's an anti-war and anti-racist movement, because of the attacks that we've seen in Canada and the U.S. and elsewhere.
Do you think that I understand that George Bush is using the crisis or the cover of the crisis to now try and fast track the FTA? Do you have any information on that?
There's fears of that. I'm not sure if Bush is actually that close to that. It's more of the people involved in Congress, the various congressmen and senators who want to see this go through. And I did see a report by people who are close to the fast track debate saying that yes, they were trying to push it through. But keep in mind that that could be seen as a very disgusting thing to do. But it can also be seen as perfectly natural because fast track was supposed to go through or supposed to be voted on. Sometime this fall. So either way, I think what we're going to see though is a lot of those issues are going to be sort of put on the back burner. When I say on the back burner, I mean we might not notice them as much because of the focus on the war. There's just so many issues that are being ignored. But I guess that's the nature of the media radar, that it can only handle so much at once, and it can only handle one war, and not all the other complexities of how misery and oppression is being put forward through globalization.
The target that was chosen by the terrorists in New York City, the World Trade Center, was an icon of capitalism. And are you under any illusions that the attack represented a strike against global capitalism, even with these the threat of the actual threats to the economic system in the States?
When you kill average working people, that's no attack on capitalism. That's terrorism. I'm sorry. And I talked about sloppy thinking and cheap shots. There is a certain amount of sloppy thinking from some elements in the left who use this expression, the chickens have come home to roost. I attribute that expression to Malcolm X, who was a progressive, a radical. And when he was talking about the chickens coming home to roost, I don't think he was talking about Islamic fascists, if that's who did it, keep that in mind, or whoever did it, because whoever did it must be fascistic to have that much disregard for human life. The chickens coming home to roost will be when oppressed peoples, motivated by values of social justice and solidarity and mutual aid, rise up and attack capital and power. That's when the chickens come home to roost. So the chickens didn't come home to roost on September 11th. That's what's known as blowback. The CIA, they play games in other parts of the world and it blows back in their face. There's absolutely no solace and no patting on the back that we can take from that, even though the World Trade Center is a symbol of capitalism. That's just really sloppy thinking, and when we have to suss that out. Although, again, to be honest, I haven't heard too much of that. I've heard that from wackos, but in terms of organized political groups, who are involved in day-to-day issues, that kind of talk hasn't come forward. What has come forward, though, is explaining how the prerogatives of American imperialism and foreign policy create these situations whereby this kind of thing could happen. And secondly, pointing out that what we saw in New York, that devastation, in New York City at Ground Zero, is simply part of the devastation around the world, and the Americans are seeing what people around the world experience all the time. 4,000 to 6,000 civilians were killed in Panama during Operation Just Cause, the Iraqi sanctions issues, on and on and on. So, no, I don't think there's any particular solace you can take. And even the Pentagon attack, right? These are, I guess, our military targets. That was a civilian plane that went into there. So, it's a clear act of terrorism, which is on par with the state terrorism, which is committed by the U.S., and their foreign policy.
I don't have very much time left, Jaggi, but I did want to ask one more thing, which is around the issue of you'd mentioned that we need to bring imperialism back into our vocabulary. Do you think that the anti-globalization movement, which has been focused to a large extent on corporate power rather than on state and military power, do you think we need to strengthen our analysis around state power?
Oh, absolutely. And as I pointed out, that term anti-globalization is sort of a catch-all for the fair trade, corporate power, let's reclaim democracy crowd, and the elements that have been very strongly advocating a strong anti-capitalist, anti-imperialist analysis. And this is not out of some sort of misplaced notion of ideological purity and making sure that we're always always ahead of the game and what have you. It's important. because we need to have an understanding of what we're opposed to and what we're facing in order to be able to put forward a positive vision of social change. You can't talk about peace in isolation. All we are saying is not give peace a chance. What we're talking about is peace with justice, and that includes a very comprehensive understanding of what imperialism is. And of course, I'm talking to you on Co-op Radio and using the word imperialism. We might approach people differently, but I think you'd be surprised. People have a very common sense notion of American imperialism. It's not too difficult. The average people will say America is, and not just the U.S., but Canada going along with it, and the West in general, and knowing the history of colonization and imperialism and neo-colonization, people have a very common sense understanding of that. So it's not a difficult sell. And beyond that, it's a principled way of approaching this issue, and it's important strategically, not ideologically, strategically, because I think the nature of our opposition determines the nature of oppression. And if the debate around upcoming events is simply hawks versus doves, that is people who are willing to kill for their ends, and people who are like, we don't like bombs and we don't like war, well, that's not necessarily a debate that we're going to win. But if we talk about the nature of imperialism, the nature of oppression, people fighting back, as they're doing in Chiapas, as they're doing in all parts of the world, then I think we'll have a debate and a movement, more importantly, that can really make fundamental change. To not do so is not only to shortchange ourselves, but is to strategically, it's a strategic dead end, because to talk about peace in isolation will really get us nowhere.
Jaggi, thank you very much for speaking with us this morning.
Thanks a lot.
Take care.
Bye.
I've been speaking with Jaggi Singh. He's a Montreal area activist and organizer, and he joined us by phone this morning from Victoria, where he's attending a conference on ending global militarism.
Our theme music, Unwelcome Guest, is performed by Billy Bragg and Wilco, with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. Unwelcome Guests is produced by Chris Sturr, Jesse Lind, Lynn Gary, and Sean Ewald. We are solely responsible for its content. And spread it out.